please come into my room.
Welcome to the Mustache Room. I'm your host, David Benn. Find us online at mustacheroom.com. At Mustache Room, we are sponsored by Mustache Brands. You can spell that M-U-S-T-A-S-H. Thank you so much for being with us. We are rejoined by Molly. This time she talks to us about holotropic breathwork. She's certified, spent a lot of years studying and perfecting the craft, has some really cool things to talk about. A way of getting to an altered state of consciousness without consuming any plant-based medicine. So it's purely based on breathwork and bodywork. We also get a visit from my lovely wife, Jill, and we discuss the Amanita muscaria mushroom and how people and creatures have historically consumed it for some interesting reasons, and how it might be tied to more fiction and holiday-specific fiction than you may already know. Be on the lookout for upcoming entheogenic mushroom cultivation to consumption courses. We're going to try to do more of those and partner with some fitness organizations. And send us an email, info@mustacheroom.com, if you have any questions or suggestions. Thanks again for being here. Enjoy this episode. You're in high demand these days.
Let's just say that it's not in any less demand, yes.
That's awesome. So would you say that you're doing more work with the MDMA medicine or more work with the psilocybin these days?
It's probably right down the middle.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe weighing a little bit towards the psilocybin.
It's been getting a lot of press lately. You know, there was the Newsweek article and, you know, there's always things popping up. So I could see it being more popular just because it's touching the mainstream a little bit.
Yeah, it's everywhere. So, you know, at first it was Michael Pollan's book, but now it's just the New York Times, Times Magazine. It's the thing for sure.
Cool. Well, you know, that's kind of the theme of this podcast. So I'm glad it's a thing. We'll embrace it as will everybody else. But one of the reasons that I wanted to have you back and I gave you a heads up, holotropic breathing or holotropic breath work, you see it a lot when people talk about psychedelics, enhanced forms of consciousness, mystical experiences, all that stuff. And I spoke to you real briefly about it. And a buddy of mine, Sean, who's a yoga practitioner, he's also has some experience with holotropic breath work. But I really don't know the exact sequences or, you know, the ins and outs of the type of work. So I know you having experience with it, I was hoping you could give us a little insight into how that works and what it actually yields in terms of effectiveness.
Yeah. So as of 2 years ago, I become certified as a holotropic breathwork facilitator.
Cool.
It took me 7 years.
It's like 600 hours, right?
Oh, it's a lot of time, energy, money. Yeah, it's not just a quick weekend. It's 7 week long modules, and then you have to apprentice, and then you have to have extra experiences of your own. So they make sure they, you know.
7 years, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I was on the slow track because I was working full time, and then I was going to school. So, but it's been the most, by far, valuable experience to prepare me for the work that I'm doing. So they're using holotropic breathwork. And let me just make it perfectly clear. There's a lot of forms of breathwork out there. There's many different, and they're not all one and the same. So most of them have very specific criteria. So I just want to let people know that holotropic breathwork is not the same as any other work.
Okay.
So it was developed by Stanislav Grof, who was a psychiatrist back in the 60s and 70s. He's still alive in his mid-90s. He had done a lot of facilitating LSD-assisted psychotherapy. He had administered over 2,000 hours with clients and just, you know, he was really on the cutting edge of the research along with some other people. When it became illegal, he and his wife spent 10 years really traveling the world, immersing themselves in different cultures, trying to find a way that they can induce the same experience as psychedelics, an altered state of consciousness.
Gotcha.
And he coined the term holotropic state of consciousness. Holotropic means moving towards wholeness.
Okay.
So moving towards wholeness. And the reason he coined that term is because there's many forms of altered state of consciousness that aren't necessarily in a healing context. You can have an altered state of consciousness by ingesting toxins. You can, you know, there's a lot of ways that aren't necessarily intentionally meant for healing. So he termed holotropic, moving towards wholeness, holotropic breath work. So I think it's been 35, 40 years that he and his wife spent 10 years developing this technique that incorporates the breath,
okay,
provocative music. There's some very distinct ways in which a skilled facilitator can work with the person somatically. So providing some resistance for the person to push against to catalyze a somatic breakthrough.
So the body is much more involved in this process.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So unlike psychedelics, there's actual, it can be quite cathartic. If you go to a holotropic breathwork module, which is where people go to get trained, but also the public can go, you can walk into that room and go, oh my God, what is happening? There's people screaming. You know, it can be quite dynamic.
Wow.
So it's quite different from other forms of inducing altered states of consciousness. It's often done in a group.
Okay.
The group aspect of it can be quite powerful, just bearing witness to each other. The form is such that people split up into pairs, and it's quite fascinating and magical how that actually happens. And people will tell you, oh my God, it was so bizarre. I ended up with this person and I ended up realizing I went to the same high school, or, you know, it's just quite synchronistic.
Sure.
But it's done in pairs. So you have a sitter that's there by your side. The session itself is anywhere between 2 hours and 15 minutes and 3 hours. So it's not a quick 15 minutes of breathing. There's an introduction and an orientation before everyone starts, just talking about some of the history and the form. But it's done usually in a group. People are in pairs. And one person will breathe and the other person will sit. And the sitter is there and being present for the person and meeting that person, supporting that person in any way they possibly can. So that's why they're using holotropic breathwork in some of the programs like CIIS and MAPS,
okay,
to train future psychedelic therapists, because it's the closest experiential piece that they can get, because it's illegal to use substances.
Sure. So plant-based medicine without being a factor, they can still.
Yeah. So without using substances, the holotropic breathwork is the closest that they could come to the form which they're training people to use to sit for people when the substances become legal.
So it's a one-to-one ratio between sitter and person taking person doing the breathwork?
Yeah. And then you have facilitators, depending on how big the group is, but
okay,
there's certified facilitators there. The sitters don't engage in the somatic work.
Okay.
That kind of takes a lot of skills. It's very nuanced. So it's the facilitator that would engage in helping release somatic blockages, contractions, that sort of thing.
So kind of like a yoga instructor, if you will, if you need to adjust your pose or something like that. They kind of oversee the room a little bit.
Yeah, that you kind of walk around and people might call you over and just engage, and then you kind of use intuition, like, well, maybe what if I kind of apply, meet your resistance in this area, and the person pushes, you know, uses the facilitator push against, and sometimes it can get quite dynamic.
Wow. And that's I guess you have to have a lot of trust too with your sitter or your facilitator because of the somatic element, you know, whereas with the other psychedelic experience, it's much more cerebral.
Yeah. It's much more hands off, literally.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole module that's on the body work piece. So you learn to see what the person might need. You learn how to facilitate that piece. And touch in this realm of altered states of consciousness is very, very precarious. You have to really, really know what you're doing. And you know, that those are the boundaries that can get crossed really easily, not even intentionally.
Sure.
So you have to be really careful about asking permission and communicating with the person as you're working with them, because touch in this realm, whether it's with substances or otherwise, can really re-traumatize someone if it's not done in a skillful way. You could talk to people, you could read some of Groff's stuff. I mean, anything can happen. Wow. In breath work. It's pretty, I mean, the difference is there's an off switch. So you can titrate the experience a bit more as the person. Whereas with substances, there's no turning back. You kind of, you know, you're along for the ride. You got to ride it out. With the breath work, you can use your breath to modulate it. And so sometimes people, it takes experiencing the terrain and trusting the terrain to really understand how deep you can go.
Okay.
But some people who are quite the psychonauts would tell you that they've had just as strong and a powerful experiences with the breath work as they have with psychedelics.
Oh,
so
cool.
the potential's there.
Now, when you screen people to work with, do you have extra physical considerations or things that you take into account? Okay.
Yeah. You have to be careful of cardiovascular issues, because the breathing can increase heart, you know, blood pressure,
okay,
heart rate, you know, retina, you know, issues with the eyes, anything where a buildup of pressure could be a problem. You have to be careful with breath work. So there are definitely contraindications.
Okay. And yep. How long does it take before you actually enter the mystical experience? You said 2 to 3 hours, or 2 hours and 15 minutes to 3 hours total. Does it take that long to actually get into that state, or is that the full and come down?
There's no guarantee, first of all, you're going to have a mystical experience.
Okay.
There's no guarantees. There, unlike with substances, which kind of can break through defenses, some people will do breath work and say nothing happened,
okay,
or they just can't let go because it's in a group setting. You know, the groupness can add a component to it. Some people, they'll say they're out and off and gone in 15 minutes after the music starts and they start breathing.
Okay.
Other people, you know, they might say, I didn't appreciate the potential of the experience until my fifth breath work session. It just all depends.
Okay.
So everybody's response is different.
A little less reliable or a little less consistent as opposed to a substance where you can just dose it out.
You know, yeah, it's a little, people will use voice and sound. And that's what I mean. It can be much more dynamic.
Okay.
They can move around a lot more. It's usually done on a futon mat on the floor, and there's pillows and blankets everywhere. So as a sitter and as a facilitator, you're attending to the person's safety. So they might be starting to hit the floor or something, and you're putting pillows under, or they might start moving around. I mean, people have actually experienced re-experienced their own birth. It's quite fascinating, some of the experiences people have had. So it can get very dynamic, much more so than you would see in most psychedelic sessions. Yeah.
If somebody out there was to look into working with somebody with holotropic breath work, would you say if they don't have that certification that you have, all the labor intensive training, that they should not work with that person? Or is there a sub-certification or something that might show that they have enough experience?
If a person is not certified by the Groff Transpersonal Training Organization, they can't call it holotropic breathwork.
Okay.
They could call it they can call it something else. But if someone is calling it holotropic breathwork, they are supposed to be, certified.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So,
and with the music that they play, is there, I know with my psychedelic experiences and with ours, there were a lot of instruments and not a lot of vocals where you could actually make out what they were saying, chanting, things like that. Is it similar with the breath?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The only difference is that there's a very distinct trajectory in the holotropic breathwork session, and it's broken up into three parts. So the first hour is you're kind of building up the energy. It's very percussions, drums. It's kind of getting, it's very vibrant. And then it'll get epic. There will be kind of a breakthrough. And so it's following, it's meant to carry you through this experience so that the second hour is kind of epic and more like movie track type music. And then the last hour, it kind of tapers and brings you down and is much more subtle and a little bit more relaxing. So you're kind of going through this journey. So the music, the trajectory of the music is much different.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. I figured it would have some sort of accompanying playlist. So that's interesting.
Yeah. And you'll never hear the same playlist twice. I mean, there's a whole week that's dedicated to creating it to the music.
Fantastic.
There's a whole module and there's a whole module on the bodywork. So there's a lot of nuances in training. It's not just slapping together a bunch of, you know, just soundtracks. There's quite there's an art to it.
Yeah. I read and Groff's name pops up everywhere when you read about psychedelics, but I was reading that the certification that you have, and I'm not sure it's the same exact one, 600 hours of training mandatory. And that's really exhaustive. So 7 years, 600 hours, you have to really respect the art and the practice. So
You can't get certified. They won't let you certify in less than 2 years.
Okay.
Like you can't go faster, because part of it is exploring your own inner transformation as you're going through the training, because it can be quite provocative. It can bring up things, and it's not a guarantee you're going to pass the certification. There are some people where you have to go through a 2-week kind of certification process at the end of all the requirements. And that's where you kind of get really assessed, and it's kind of, it's not a given.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
One of these days I'll have to, I don't know if you do seminars or like how you approach it, but, I'd like to see, you know, how it goes down and, you know, see if it can work for me.
Yeah, actually there's a nonprofit that we're just launching that I'm helping with. It's called the Groff Legacy Project.
Oh, cool.
And they're going to have two tracks. They're going to have a breathwork track where people can engage with what's the equivalent of holotropic breathwork. And then there's going to be the psychedelic experience track, which is very experiential and intended to actually, I hate to say train, but train people in like what MAPS is doing in CIES.
Yeah.
But those programs are much less experiential. There's not a lot of actually sitting with people while they're in an altered state of consciousness. And most of it's very academic, very intellectual. So this would provide people with an opportunity to get trained in this realm from a much more experiential place.
Nice. Where is that taking place?
If it's not open to
the public, we can talk privately, but I was,
it is open to the
public.
Cool.
All right.
There are certain pieces that are open. Like we're going to have a 4-day breathwork retreat scheduled for October, but we canceled because of COVID.
Yeah.
So there's going to be some opportunities where people can come and just experience holotropic breathwork. And get two breathworks in over the course of 4 days. So I can keep you posted.
Yeah, please.
But if people Google Groff Legacy Project USA, they can join the community and be on the email list. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So
if people are really, you know, if you're concerned about ingesting any kind of plant-based medicine, or you just have whatever reservations, there's no medicine involved. So, you know, it's, I guess, a nice alternative.
Exactly. And I used to, when it was more accessible, really encourage people to, if there was access to it in their community, to go through a holotropic breathwork, because the form is very similar. There's a lot of the principles that are similar. So it's a great entryway into the psychedelic realm for sure.
Very cool.
Yeah.
You mentioned music, and I wanted to, are you familiar with Gabrielle Roth?
Yeah.
I just came across
five
the music.
Rhythms or five, is it five rhythms?
Yeah. I haven't really delved into that, but apparently she has matched up life with five different distinct rhythms.
Yeah. She's been around for ages, David.
Yeah. She was born in the early 40s, I think.
Yeah, I know.
So my buddy at work, he goes to Burning Man all the time. And he I was like, give me somebody that, you know, is very heavy on the instrumentals and like plays well with psychedelics. And he introduced me to Gabrielle Roth. She's awesome. I was so smitten by going through the stuff she's done. Have you used her at all in any of your work?
You know, there's others that are more kind of popular, but yeah, if you go to a breathwork, you'll see her music inserted here and there for sure.
Can you make any, like overall, doesn't have to be specific to holotropic breathwork, but can you make any suggestions for those of us that are, you know, looking for somebody that has psychedelic friendly music or playlist?
Yeah. Byron Metcalf is a big one.
Okay.
He's quite popular. Mark Selig is another popular sort of, Lisa Gerrard from The Dead Can Dance. She's an amazing, she's a vocalist, but it's, again, there's no lyrics.
Sure.
She's one of my favorites.
Nothing to draw into, no vocals or anything to get consumed.
Yeah,
by.
Nothing you're going to probably associate with. She did a lot of the music for Whale Rider. Remember that movie?
No.
That's an old one. But Lisa Gerrard is a big one.
Okay.
There's some. Oh God, you're putting me on the spot. But
sorry, I should have given you a heads up.
Wait, I can pull up my playlist.
Yeah.
Spotify as I'm looking here. Karunish is a group. You know, that's another popular one. Stephen Halpern.
Okay.
Let me see. Not Macy Gray. Yeah. Lisa Gerrard. Peter Cater. There's some piano kind of cello music. Peter Cater is one of those. Sylvia Nakach, she's a great one.
Okay.
I could go on.
No, that's a good list. I'll make sure that I include those in the show notes, but that gives us a handful to run with.
Then there's a lot of Native American music that's really nice too. Joanne Shenandoah.
Okay.
She's another one. But yeah, some of the Native music can go really well. Michael Hopp is another one. Yeah. Music's a powerful component to this work. It can really, it's meant to be a carrier wave. And it can also bring up things with people. You know, if we say in breath work, like if you didn't like the music and it's activating you that way, then kind of use that.
Okay.
Kind of, you know.
There's something about it that's triggering.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of look into, you know, what is that and work with the trigger. The key is it shouldn't be a distraction. And so that's why I'll say to people, if the music isn't working and, you know, I've had people say, you know, there'd be piano and they're like, oh my God, can you turn the piano off? I used to play piano as a kid and my piano teacher is coming up. You know, it's just, so there's, you know, sometimes people have associations with just that and you don't want it to be that whole focus. So, yeah.
Sure. How much integration are you doing like with the holotropic breathwork? Is it consistent with what you do with the other medicines?
Yeah, it's really important. And there's a whole art piece component to the holotropic breathwork where people are invited to go to an art space and create a mandala. So it's quite potent. The idea is that a lot of times getting images down, it's not supposed to be an art piece, but just getting images down before you put words to the experience can be quite powerful. So, you know, that's the psyche. The psyche talks in images and symbols and metaphors. So it's quite amazing what when you see someone's mandala, it's like it can just blow your mind. And they don't know where it came from sort of thing. But
yeah,
so there is a whole piece there. And then in the breath work, we'll usually have a closing circle each evening. Or if it's a big, big group, I mean, some of these breath works are 80 people, 100 people. So they'll break up into smaller groups in the evening so that there's a way that you can put voice and people can bear witness to your experience. So yeah, the integration is a big piece.
Wow, 80 to 100 people. That's got to be intimidating for some.
Yeah, it's those are the big ones. Those are the quote modules, which they're not like me holding a 2-day retreat. These are the modules where future facilitators are going, but the public can also go, and they're, and each module is themed. So one might be the holotropic principles. So it's all about the principles of holotropic breathwork. Another one might be the music. So, but yeah, it can draw quite a crowd.
For the people listening, I really appreciate you taking the time to educate us. And now, we've learned a lot from you in the past, in the couple episodes that you've been on. So hopefully we can wrangle you in for another one, but thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yeah, and people can Google holotropic breathwork, and there's so much that comes up, or Stanislav Grof. Yeah.
Fantastic.
He's quite an institution or a figure in this work, so for sure.
That's great. Well, Molly, I'll let you get back to your work, whatever you're up to. But we'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
Okay, David.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye. And now it's time for some education as my lovely wife Jill joins us to talk about mushrooms and health.
You want my wisdom?
Very wise woman.
And then the baby's away.
Baby's away. We can't have the baby anywhere near us for a podcast.
No, it does not work out.
Yeah, just so you know, we tried a couple times. We failed both times. And so we realized when the baby goes to bed, then we can try to record a podcast.
Yeah, or do anything at all.
Exactly. So here we are. And Brody's here silently, hopefully. And we're glad to be back. Post-ternity. Episode number 2.
Post-ternity.
So I had my class. I had my entheogenic mushrooms consumption cultivation class.
Woohoo.
Yes, at Dark Horse Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in Denver, Colorado. And we had about 8 people there.
Nice.
Which I thought was a decent turnout. We drank some beers, which I felt was good for just the morale and the comfort level in the classroom.
Yeah.
You know, there's no curriculum or any scholastic constraints. Mm-hmm. So it was fun. Lasted about 3.5 hours, I'd say.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And I constructed the curriculum on my own. Basically, I went through who I am, why I'm doing this, my qualifications for being a teacher, you know, my background as a stand-up comedian, my background as a Microsoft certified trainer, yada, 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 and also my experiences with psychedelics. And I wanted to make sure that there was a trust level and I gained credibility because, you know, I'm not some scientist nerd, you know, I'm somebody that's
like you're a real guy.
I lived a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
So I did that. And then I talked about entheogens. Psychedelics and risks.
So entheogens mean psychedelic.
Essentially.
Is that just like a fancy word for it?
It really is.
Okay. And,
you know, psychedelics, there's stigma connotations attached to that term.
Yeah.
So I like to use entheogen, but it's essentially synonymous with psychedelic.
Okay.
Theology is the study of religion. And so there's a little bit of intertwined meaning there, but essentially it's the same thing.
That's interesting how like the study of religion, like theology, and entheogen is psychedelic. So how is that connected?
Well, there's the same etymology there somewhere.
Okay.
But essentially the, you know,
like
it is
God, like there's some sort of God.
Yeah. And depending on which substance you're working with, like there's Mother Ayahuasca and people see deities and other greater powers in some instances. So there is a little bit of overlap.
Okay. I could see that where like in the past mushrooms have been used in religious ceremonies.
Absolutely.
And psychedelics have been used, not like just for fun, you know, it has been used for like a purpose.
I mean, definitely for fun.
Now
60s and 70s for sure.
Yeah. But I feel like most people assume that it's more tied to just fun and recreational versus you know, more of the religious or the healing aspect of it.
Well, the Native Americans have kind of, they have the monopoly on peyote, or they're at least trying to keep the monopoly on peyote because of its, it takes a lot of time to cultivate and, you know, they really, it's something that they use in their religious ceremonies. So it's very sacred to them.
Yeah.
So for a Westerner to say, hey, I guess you know, they're Westerners too, but for somebody to be like, hey, I want to use your medicine in my willy-nilly ceremony or for my experimentation, it kind of trivializes their religion and their ceremony and how they hold it dear.
Yeah. And I know, because where did we learn about that? Was it a documentary? Was it an article?
Might have been a podcast or something where we heard some of those.
It was really interesting because peyote, which is the cactus.
Yeah. Mescaline.
Mescaline.
Yeah.
It only grows in certain areas, which has been on native land. And
in Texas, mostly in the States. There's an area in Texas that's plentiful with peyote.
Yeah. And they're trying to preserve the original plants because you can reseed and grow it, but it's not the same because it doesn't have the same like sacred.
It's not that as much as it is. It's, you know, if people start harvesting it and start using it for things outside of their religious internal use, there might be less of a supply for them to actually use for ceremony. It just, I don't know, it takes away from their ability to kind of corner the market and control it as they see fit. And essentially, because it's so sacred to them, a lot of the decriminalized nature movements and stuff are having exceptions for the Native Americans and peyote because of the fact that it's so sacred.
Yeah, I mean, we've already taken so much from
them. I know, right?
Like
we're about to celebrate Thanksgiving, which is just a huge dump on their history.
Yeah.
Christopher Columbus is already on the outs. So Thanksgiving might be next.
Are you even allowed to say his name?
I might have to go back.
We just had Indigenous People Day.
Yeah.
That was recent. It used to be Columbus Day, which now you don't say that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, if you really look at it objectively, we're probably better off not celebrating him in his entirety, you know?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Explorer and whatnot, maybe he had some accomplishments, but there was a lot of genocide and a lot of imperialism that we can't really get behind.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like anyone in that era, that was kind of like your way of survival and your way of, you know, conquering, if you will. Yeah. It's just not how we operate today.
So getting back to the course, I wanted to convey, you know, why I resorted to plant-based medicine for my own therapy, what it's done for me, how it manages my default mode network, yada, yada, yada. And I think, you know, building up my relationship with the plant-based medicine and using it respectfully, I think that gave a comfort level with the students to where, okay, this guy may know what he's talking about and, you know, we'll hear him out.
Yeah. I mean, and I think too, for like even just men to be open to discussing challenges that they may have and, you know, letting them know that there's alternatives to look at instead of just traditional prescriptions and pharmaceuticals, you know, to deal with things. I think you were leading by with a great example.
Yeah. And Andrew was there. Felix was there. Felix took a lot of photos and video. Props to Felix. Jackie was actually there with Andrew. So a lot of mushroom enthusiasts that have been on this podcast before made an appearance during the course, and a lot of help from Felix and Andrew just kind of, you know, throughout the course of the course. But yeah, we talked about cultivation, all the different steps, the sterilization requirements. We looked at photos of different types of casing, stages of fruiting, and, you know, all the different facets of mushroom cultivation. We talked about dosing, micro, macro, mini dosing, different ways to consume, the risks, you know, how to do it responsibly and how to set your set and setting, how to, you know, kind of nurture the environment, make sure you vet your peers, all the big tenets of responsible use of psychedelics. And finally, we talked about integration and just the importance of making sense of your experience and having somebody that you feel comfortable with, you know, opening up and kind of making sure that whatever happened resonates positively and it's a sustained improvement.
So high level, you take a dose, usually a high dose.
This is very high level.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying like for the audience.
For sure. Yeah.
So you take a large dose, you retreat to yourself. Is that correct?
Yeah. If I was to macro dose a heroic dose, or if I was to go big, then I would establish a set and setting that was extremely comfortable.
Okay.
So that I could fully surrender.
So temperature, noise, like eye mask, like completely comfortable, like at a spa, if you will.
Well, I guess the things that I pointed out, the things that are really important to me and important for me to convey to other people, the people you're with, the things on your mind, the devices available, anything that can interrupt your experience or cause anxiety or take your mind somewhere else, you know, those are things that can really compromise both your set and your setting.
Okay.
I mean, if you're with people that you don't feel comfortable with and, you know, something happens, you'll internalize that and it can completely ruin your experience.
Okay.
So you really have to be mindful of your set and setting. So that was really something that we spent a lot of time on, and it's completely up to you. You know, at the last minute, if you feel like you're set, when I say set, I mean your mindset.
Yeah.
If you don't feel like your mindset is adequate to really go deep, then you're better off not doing it.
Okay. And so if you've got like a long list of chores or something due the next day, it's probably not the best time.
Yeah. Or, you know, your kid is staying at, you know, somebody else's house, sleeping over at somebody's house, you know, something like that where you don't have full control of the situation and there are factors that could cause you to doubt your circumstances.
Okay. So that's that. So you take your heroic dose. You
shout out to Terrence McKenna.
You're in your set and your setting and you're enjoying it. Now the integration, when does that come in? Is that immediately like when you're like, oh, I start to feel normal again? Or is that like the next day? Is that by yourself? Are you working that with someone? Like, how do you personally integrate?
So the best way to do it, if you have a relationship with a therapist, is see if your therapist is open-minded to psychedelics. You know, if your therapist says, hey, I'm familiar with psychedelics or I appreciate the space, you can talk openly with them about doing plant-based medicine and kind of have them act as the bookends for your experience.
So a meet like hour five.
No, I mean, I don't think you should look at it that way. Whenever you're ready, I mean, you're going to jot stuff down throughout your experience.
Okay. So that's a good point.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you don't want to be conscious of, oh shoot, I have to remember this or I have to write stuff down. So it has to be organic. That's why if you have a trip sitter or somebody, you know, they can jot things down for you that you audibly express to them, things like that. But essentially you're going to want to digest and fully allow things to resonate once the experience is over. And so the timing is, it could fluctuate, but you know, it could be immediately once you're fully, you know, come down from the medicine, but it could be the next day. It could last the entire next week. And it's a process that's kind of, it's tailored to the extreme nature of your experience, I guess.
Okay. No, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
And then I know you've actually done voice, like you've done like videos into your phone during it too. I don't know if you've ever gone back and looked at those, but.
I mean, I have. Yeah. You start to get creative and you start to think of things that you normally wouldn't. And so, you know, sometimes you get really excited and you want to share things with the world. So it's best that you have a mechanism to record that stuff.
Yeah.
So if you're doing it with a sitter, which is always a good idea if you're new to the experience, they can record that stuff for you and just take the responsibility away. Cool. Or you can just shout into a voice recorder or whatever, you know, Alexa, take a note for me or something.
Oh, yeah.
Just as long as you don't expect to have a dialogue with Alexa, that would be bad. That would be interesting. That could turn horribly if you're on a psychedelic experience.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, that was in a nutshell, very high level. And then I had resources so that people could go and, you know, figure out how to make bulk casing or agar, liquid culture, soup to nuts, start to finish with mushroom cultivation, and then all kinds of publications and resources, Double Blind magazine, and just things that are really good for people that are either new to the space or really want to go a little bit deeper to the existing space.
That's great.
Yeah. So that was fun. And I hopefully will have more of those. I've been talking to Sean, who was on the podcast a couple times actually, about maybe doing it with his yoga establishment. So fingers crossed, but we'll keep it going. And if anybody's interested, definitely email the podcast info@mustacheroom.com or info@mustachebrands.com. As always, mustache, M-U-S-T-A-S-H. We also wanted to talk about a follow-up from a previous episode. I can't remember. Were we together talking about it on the previous episode?
I feel like we always have a follow-up and we forget to follow up.
Yeah. Well,
so what are you following up on?
Okay. Amanita muscaria, aka fly agaric. We talked about how it's kind of the most, it's the most recognizable mushroom.
Yeah.
It's the Mario mushroom. It's the mushroom that has the same color scheme as Santa Claus.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of fiction that's derived from this type of mushroom. It's the red cap with the white speckles.
Yeah. And it grows plentiful in Colorado, apparently.
Oh, yeah. When I was in Telluride for the mushroom festival, a lot of the people on the foray came back with huge Amanita muscaria mushrooms. Huge.
And when you say huge, how big? Like the size of your hand? Could be like
The cap was like 5 inches in diameter.
That's a huge ass.
Yeah. Like a coffee can, a little bit smaller than a coffee can.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And then the shade of red varies, right? It could be bright or it could be like an orangey red.
Yeah, I would say the spectrum would be like just bright red to like a darker brick red.
Okay, that's a good one.
Yeah, so in that spectrum, but it definitely has those white dots. They almost look like zits. It's kind of gross on there. But
what about moles?
Moles. They're white moles. They're albino moles, if you will. Yes. So Amanita muscaria. I have never consumed Amanita muscaria. I've heard from Paul Stamets and some other people that are pretty well known in the space that it may cause stomach discomfort. So I guess I'm being a little bit of a scaredy pants. But I know Chris wants to try it, so it may happen. But ultimately, it's supposed to cause some sort of hallucinogenic effect, some sort of psychedelic experience, not akin to psilocybin, but still kind of freaky.
And I don't know. Do we have data if people have died from taking this one?
No, I don't think the poison is that extreme. I think it's more of just maybe digestive system issue
or based on how much you consume.
Yeah.
But I will, when we went to Telluride last year and we went to their farmer's market and they were selling, there was a mushroom stand.
Yeah.
And we found a dried bag of this mushroom. And David was like, oh my God, it's like the mythical, you know, creature. And we grabbed some and we were talking with the guy and we're like, how do you cook with this? Because he was selling all culinary mushrooms.
Yeah.
And this was the only one that he had, you know, on the spectrum, if you will. So
on the spectrum.
Well, yeah, like the psychedelic spectrum.
There you go.
So he said, and he kind of chuckled like, well, like we were kind of talking the same language. And he's like, well, because they're dried and you rehydrate them and then you can cook with them, but you do not want to drink the liquid is what he said. And if you just think of all the science with it, psilocybin mycelium is how it grows. Psilocybin is water soluble. So the psychoactive element is in the water. It's not in the mushroom itself. So when you rehydrate the mushrooms, it pulls out the psychedelic. So we can easily rehydrate these and cook with them. It's the water that would then make you high.
Gotcha.
Or give you the effect.
And in that book we bought from the Telluride Mushroom Festival, the culinary mushroom book.
Yes.
He talks about exactly how to prepare Amanita muscaria to nullify any of those weird body effects or things that the average person wouldn't want to experience.
Exactly. And so
it was in the ceviche that he served.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can still, like, if you find these and you want to consume them, not the typical reason, you can, well, I guess his wouldn't be dried out if you found them fresh. I wonder how you would do that fresh.
Yeah, normally they're not going to be dried.
Maybe just boiled. Maybe if you boiled them. And it would pull out the toxin.
But yeah, if you look online on how to prepare Amanita muscaria mushrooms for culinary use, there's a method to get rid of the toxins.
Okay.
And again, we can't firsthand speak for the toxins and what that means.
We've not done it. Yeah.
So I may have a follow-up episode. There's that follow-up promise again.
And no, we need to jot down the follow-ups.
Yeah, we need to have some show notes. Brody, all right, he's just sitting there. So yeah, the cool thing though is deer for some time, and you may have heard this, other people talk about it, but deer have specifically found this particular mushroom to be a nice little treat for them reindeer specifically. And so if you think about the hallucinogenic effects on a reindeer and how they have a fondness for Amanita muscaria mushrooms, flying reindeer with Santa seems all that more plausible based on this sort of reality.
What's the difference between a deer and a reindeer?
Ooh, I...
because, and I'm wondering, because they grow in Colorado and there's deer in Colorado, is it just...
Here, the main difference between deer and reindeer, which, why is it spelled R-E-I-N? Anyway, the main difference between deer and reindeer is that the deer is adapted to moderate climates, whereas the reindeer is adapted to cold climates.
Okay, so like more northern territory.
Yeah, like a polar deer.
I like that.
Yeah.
Polar deer.
So it's a polar deer.
Okay.
And so anyways, deer, reindeer, okay. I'll just consider them interchangeable.
Because we can call just Colorado deer, you know, they eat the same thing and it's same sure. effects.
Sure. Yeah, it all sounds good.
Okay.
So deer versus reindeer, now you have that knowledge. You
I
can
love
put that,
it.
You can put that in your pocket. They like the Amanita muscaria and they actually... they influenced people to harvest their urine, like reindeer herders and other people that were farming to harvest their urine so that they could harness those same effects, the same hallucinogenic, man, I cannot say that word, the same, we'll say psychedelic effects that were impacting the reindeer that were consuming it.
How are they collecting the urine?
That's another good question. I don't have that answer.
That,
I don't believe there's a follow-up for that.
That there's no follow-up. That is proprietary information.
Definitely. So the reason that they were harvesting the urine, and again, we don't have the means that they used.
Oh, I think I just kind of jumped ahead. So they found the herders started collecting urine, testing it out to see if they could have the effects.
No, I think they just looked at the reindeer and the reindeer... Let's see, they have, there's, it says here what happens to them.
But if they saw the reindeer eating the mushrooms, why didn't they just skip the urine and eat the mushrooms?
That's a good question too. And I don't have the answer to that either.
No follow up.
No follow up. It said here that if they eat the fungi or fungi, depending on which one you prefer, they behave, and this is the reindeer, behave drunkenly, run about aimlessly, and make strange noises. Head twitching is also common. So maybe they saw this happen and they're like, the only way I can harness the energy of these reindeer is to drink their piss. And lo and behold, it worked for them. And we have some science and we have some terms that I still can't pronounce that explain why the urine is so plentiful. Ooh. With things that make you feel drunken.
Actually, go back to that article.
Oh, okay.
So it says okay. So these mushrooms have long been used by man, but are known to be toxic. So they try to avoid eating them directly, whereas the reindeer can eat them without any harm.
Ah.
And then they observe their effects. So they were so gung-ho on getting high that they're like, let's drink some piss.
Yeah, and that's amazing that the reindeer can just eat as much as they want, completely immune. They can just get a little drunker.
Yeah, they have, you know, different ways to process it.
That's crazy. So there's the science behind this. And basically it says the removal of the carboxyl radical from ibotenic acid that the Amanita muscaria contains results in the psychoactive molecule musimol or musimol. This transformation of molecules is driven by the metabolic process of decarboxylization.
Decarboxylation.
Yes. Decarboxylation. However, the liver is not very efficient at this process. So about 85% of the ingested ibotenic acid leaves the body unaltered via urine. Your piss contains 5 times the amount of the drug that your body is capable of absorbing. So basically what that means is you don't really get much out of consuming the actual mushroom. You only get 15% of the psychoactive components. The other 85% leaves your body in your piss. So if you were to drink that, if you consume that urine, it says, if you've consumed a mushroom, you can piss into a bottle and hand it over to your buddy who drinks it and becomes a temporary drug mule. Then later on, he pisses into the same bottle, hands it over to the next person in line, blah, blah, blah. Essentially 5 or 6 times, it says. So once it's activated in the urine, it becomes 85% potent, and it continues that way, essentially. So it's a, what is that, a human centipede of of psychoactive urine?
Oh, God, that South Park episode.
That's crazy.
I mean, I have to point out, it would be ill will if we don't do this, but drinking your urine is not good, or drinking someone's urine is not good.
That's why one of the reasons we have you here is to tell us what we should put in our body. So tell us why urine is not good to put in our body.
So
even though it's already in our body.
So your kidneys filter out toxins. So okay. Anything you eat, anything you drink, it goes through your kidneys and it filters out these toxins that are then excreted from your body. So some things are absorbed, some things are not.
Okay.
For instance, like artificial sugars, your body can't absorb them. They literally just pass through your body.
As diarrhea.
Or in your urine.
Oh, okay.
Like your urine can end up like smelling sweet.
Ooh.
Don't drink it. But
it's the antithesis of asparagus.
So by drinking urine that has filtered all the toxins, because your body wants to eat and utilize the resources you're giving it. But there are things that it can't absorb or things that it doesn't want to absorb. So it passes through.
Yeah.
So by drinking the waste,
ooh,
your urine, you're consuming these toxins that your body explicitly intended to remove. So it can lead to kidney damage, kidney disease, as those organs need to work harder to handle the increased concentration of toxic substances.
Damn.
So every time you keep drinking urine that has been, like, let's say you keep drinking your own urine over and over again.
Yeah.
Like, that's straight up kidney failure.
Yeah. So it just keeps compounding the amount of toxins that you
exactly.
have.
Exactly.
Like compound interest in the bank. Good thing for money.
Bad thing for your kidneys.
Boom. Yeah. Wow. So, okay. The moral of the story is if you can't find any other way to get high, we shouldn't say high. If you can't find any other way to alter your state of consciousness using Amanita muscaria and you have to resort to pee, just think about what impact that's going to have on your liver.
Yeah. I mean, now if you're stranded on a boat in the ocean,
hey, yeah.
your pee is less of a toxin than the salt water. So drink your pee.
Boom. And if it happens to have Amanita muscaria, then it's a bonus.
Then you might not actually be floating in the ocean.
Oh, that's funny. So did you have any other wisdom for us, Buet? I think we educated the audience pretty well today.
I think that was enough education for one yeah. for one episode. You'll have to tune in next time.
Fucking A. All right, thanks.
Bye.
Walk with me, walk with me, baby, come on and talk with me, come on and take me down, down. Girl, walk with me, walk with me, baby, come on and talk with me, come on and take me down, down. Girl, walk with me, baby, talk with me, take me down, down. Girl, walk with me, baby, talk with me, take me down.